I will examine him myself, shouted the senior official. Two other officers stood by me, their faces showing considerable concern. One attempted to remonstrate, but was told roughly to shut up. I was taken to a room, and soon the irate officer appeared. He looked through my case, throwing my things on the floor. He searched the linings and bottom of the battered old case. Chagrined that nothing was to be found, he demanded my passport. Ah! He exclaimed, you have a visa and a work permit. The officer in New York had no authority to issue both. It is left to our discretion here in England. He was beaming with triumph, and with a theatrical gesture he tore my passport right across and threw it in the rubbish container. On an impulse, he picked up the tattered remnants, and stuffed them in his pocket. Ringing a bell, two men came in from the outer office. This man has no papers, he said, he will have to be deported, take him to the holding cell. But, sir, said one of the officers, I actually saw them, they were in order. Are you questioning my ability? Roared the senior man. Do as I say. A man sadly took my arm. Come on, he said. I was marched out and lodged in a bare cell. By Jove, old boy, said the bright young man from the Foreign Office when he entered my cell much, much later. All this is a frightful pother, what? He stroked his baby smooth chin and sighed noisily. You see our position, old chap, it really is just too simply desperate. You must have had papers, or the Wallers in Quebec would not have let you embark. Now you have no papers. They must have been lost overboard. QED old boy, what? I mean to say. I glowered at him and remarked, my papers were deliberately torn up. I demand that I be released and be permitted to land. Yes, yes, replied the bright young man, but can you prove it? I have had a gentle breeze in my ear which told me exactly what happened. We have to stand by our uniformed staff, or the press would be around our ears. Loyalty and esprit de corps, and all that sort of thing. So, I said, you know the truth, that my papers were destroyed, yet you, in this much vaunted land of the free, can stand blandly aside and watch such persecution. My dear fellow, you merely had the passport of a resident of an annexed state, you are not a Commonwealth member by birth. I'm afraid you are rather out of our orbit. Now, Chappie, unless you agree that your papers were, lost overboard, we shall have to make a case against you for illegal entry. That might net you a stretch in the cooler for up to 2 years. If you play ball with us, you will merely be returned to New York. New York? Why New York? I asked. If you return to Quebec, you might cause us some trouble. We can prove that you came from New York. So it is up to you. New York or up to 2 years as an involuntary guest of His Majesty. He added as an afterthought, of course, you would still be deported after you had served your sentence, and the authorities would gladly confiscate that money which you have. Our suggestion will enable you to keep it. The bright young man stood up and brushed imaginary specks of dust from his immaculate jacket. Think it over, old boy, think it over, we offer you a perfectly wizard way out. With that he turned and left me alone in the cell. Stodgy English food was brought in and I attempted to cut it up with the bluntest knife I have ever used. They might have thought that in my extremity I contemplated suicide. Well, no one would commit suicide with that knife. The day wore on. A friendly guard tossed in some English newspapers. After a glance I put them aside. So far as I could see they dealt only in sex and scandal. With the coming of darkness I was brought a thick mug of cocoa and a slice of bread and margarine. The night was chilly, with a dankness that reminded me of tombs and mouldering bodies. The morning guard greeted me with a smile which threatened to crack his stony face. You leave tomorrow, he said. A ship's captain has agreed to take you if you work your passage. You will be turned over to the New York police when you arrive. Later in the morning an official arrived to tell me officially, and to tell me that I would be doing the hardest work aboard ship, trimming coal in the bunkers of an ancient freighter with no labor-saving devices at all. There would be no pay and I would have to sign the articles to say that I agreed to those terms. In the afternoon I was taken down to the shipping agent, under guard, where, in the presence of the captain, I signed the articles. 24 hours later, still under guard, I was taken to the ship and locked in a small cabin, being told that I would have to remain there until the ship was beyond the limits of territorial waters. Soon the thudding of the old engine awakened the ship to sluggish life. There was the clatter of heavy feet above me, and by the rise and fall of the deck I knew that we were heading out into a choppy sea. Not until Portland Bill was well off to starboard, and receding in the distance, was I released. "Git Kraken, chum," said the fireman, handing me a battered shovel and rake. "Clean out them the holes of clinker. Take 'em on deck and dump 'em. Look lively, now. Or looky here," bawled the huge man in the forecastle later when I went there. "We got a gook, or chink or a Jap. Hey you," he said, slapping me across the face, "remember Pearl Harbor?" "Let 'em be, Butch," said another man, "the cops are after 'em." "Haw haw," roared Butch, "let's give 'em a workin' over fust, just for Pearl Harbor." He sailed into me, fists going like pistons, and becoming more and more furious as none of his blows reached me. "Slippery swab, eh?" he grunted, reaching out in an attempt to get my throat in a stranglehold. Old Sue, and others in far off Tibet had well prepared me for such things. I dropped, limp, and Butcher's momentum carried him forward. He tripped over me and smashed his face on the edge of the forecastle table, breaking his jaw and nearly severing an ear on a mug which he broke in his fall. I had no more trouble with the crew. Slowly the New York skyline loomed up ahead of us. We plowed on, leaving a black wake of smoke in the sky from the inferior coal we were using. Alaska Stoker, looking fearfully over his shoulder, edged up to me. "De cops come for you soon," he said. "You good man," heard Chief saying what Cap'n told him. "They got to keep their noses clean." He passed me over an oilskin tobacco pouch. "Put your money in that and slip over the side before day gets you ashore," he whispered confidentially, telling me where the police boat would head, telling me where I could hide, as he had done in the past. I listened with great care as he told me how to escape the police hunt after I had jumped overboard. He gave me names and addresses of people who would help me, and he promised to get in touch with them when he went ashore. "I have been in trouble like this," he said. "I got framed because of th color of my skin." "Hey, you," a voice bawled from the bridge. "The captain wants you. Double to it." I hurried up to the bridge. The mate jerked a thumb in the direction of the chart room. The captain was sitting at a table looking over some papers. "Ah," he said, as he looked up at me. "I put you in charge of the police. Have you anything to tell me first?" "Sir," I replied, "my papers were all in order, but a senior customs officer tore them up." He gazed at me and nodded, looked at his papers again, and apparently made up his mind. "I know the man you mean. I have had trouble with him myself. The face of officialdom must be saved, no matter what misery it causes for others. I know your story is true, for I have a friend at customs who confirmed your tale." He looked down again and fiddled with the papers. "I have a complaint here that you were a stowaway." "But, sir," I exclaimed, "the British Embassy in New York can confirm who I am. The shipping agents in Quebec can do likewise." "My man," sadly said the captain, "you do not know the ways of the West. No inquiries will be made. You will be taken ashore, placed in a cell, tried, convicted, and sent to prison. Then you will be forgotten. When the time for your release is near, you will be detained until you can be deported back to China." "That will be death, sir," I said. He nodded. "Yes, but the course of official duty will have been followed. We on this ship had an experience, way back in Prohibition days. We were arrested on suspicion and heavily fined, yet we were quite innocent." He opened the drawer in front of him and took out a small object. "I will tell the police that you have been framed. I will help you all I can. They may handcuff you, but they will not search you until they get you ashore. Here is a key which fits the police handcuffs. I will not give it to you, but will place it here, and turn away." He placed the shiny key in front of me, rose from his desk, and turned to the chart behind him. I picked up the key and put it in my pocket. "Thank you, sir," I said. "I feel better for your faith in me." In the distance I saw the police boat coming up towards us. a white cascade of spray at the bows. Smartly it came alongside, executed a half turn, and edged in towards us. The ladder was lowered, and two policemen came aboard and made their way up to the bridge, amid sour looks from members of the crew. The captain greeted them, giving them a drink and cigars. Then he produced the papers from his desk. "This man has worked well. In my opinion, he has been framed by a government official. Given time to call at the British Embassy, he could prove his innocence." The senior policeman looked cynical. "All these guys are innocent. The penitentiaries are full of innocent men who have been framed. To listen to them. All we want is to get him tucked nicely in a cell and then we go off duty. Kman, fella," he said to me. I turned to pick up my case. "Or, you won't want that," he said, hustling me along. On an afterthought he snapped the handcuffs round my wrists. "Oh, you don't want that," called the captain. "He can't run anywhere, and how will he get down to your boat?" "He can fall in the drink and we will fish him out," replied the policeman, laughing coarsely. Climbing down the ladder was not easy, but I managed it without mishap, to the obvious regret of the police. Once on the cutter, they took no more notice of me. We sped along past many ships and rapidly approached the police jetty. "Now is the time," I thought, and with a quick leap I was over the side, allowing myself to sink. With acute difficulty I slipped the key in the lock, and turned. The handcuffs came off and sank. Slowly, very slowly, I rose to the surface. The police cutter was a long way off. The men spotted me, and started firing. Bullet splashes were all around me as I sank again. Swimming strongly until I felt that my lungs would burst, I surfaced again. The police were far off, searching round the obvious place where I would be expected to land. I crawled ashore at the least obvious place, but will not mention it in case some other unfortunate should need refuge. For hours I lay on half-sunken timbers, shivering and aching, with the scummy water swirling round me. There came the creak of rowlocks and the splashing of oars in the water. A rowboat with three policemen came into sight. I slid off the beam, and let myself sink in the water so that only my nostrils were above the surface. Although I was hidden by the beam, I kept in readiness for instant flight. The boat prowled up and down. At long, long last a hoarse voice said, "Guess he's a stiff by now. His body will be recovered later. Let's get off for some coffee." The boat drifted out of my range. After a long interval I dragged my aching body on the beam again, shivering almost uncontrollably. The day ended, and stealthily I inched along the beam to a half-rotten ladder. Gingerly I climbed up, and seeing no one, darted for the shelter of a shed. Stripping off my clothing, I wrung them as dry as possible. Off to the end of the wharf a man appeared, the Lascar. As he came down and was opposite me, I gave a low whistle. He stopped, and sat upon a bollard. "You can come out cautious-like," he said. "De cops be sure out in force on de other side. Man, you sure got dem boys rattled." He stood up and stretched, and looked around him. "Follow me," he said, "but I don't know you if you is caught. A colored gentleman is waiting wit a truck. When we get due you climb in de back and cover yourself with de tarp." He moved away, and giving him plenty of time, I followed, slipping from one shadowed building to another. The lapping of water around the piles and the far-off wail of a police car were the only sounds disturbing the peace. Suddenly there was the rattle of a truck engine being started and tail lights appeared just ahead. A huge Negro nodded to the Lascar and gave me, following behind, a friendly wink as he gestured to the back of his truck. Painfully I climbed in and pulled the old tarpaulin over me. The truck moved on and stopped. The two men climbed out and one said, "We gotta load up a bit now, move forward." I crawled towards the driver's cab, and there was the clatter of boxes being loaded on. The truck moved on, jolting over the rough roads. Soon it came to a halt, and a rough voice yelled, "What have you got there, folks?"
"Only garbage, sir," said the Negro. Heavy footsteps came along beside me. Something poked about in the rubbish at the back.
"Okay," said the voice, "on your way." A gate clanged, the Negro shifted into gear, and we drove out into the night.
We seemed to drive for hours, then the truck turned sharply, braked, and came to a halt. The tarpaulin was pulled off, and there stood the Lascar and the Negro, grinning down at me. I stirred wearily, and felt for my money. "I will pay you," I said.
"Pay nothing," said the Negro.
"Butch was going to kill me before we reached New York," said the Lascar. "You saved me, now I save you, and we put up a fight against the discrimination against us. Come on in." Race, creed, and color do not matter, I thought. All men bleed red. They led me into a warm room where there were two light-colored Negro women. Soon I was wrapped in hot blankets, eating hot food. Then, they showed me a place where I could sleep, and I drifted off. Chapter 7. For 2 days and nights I slept, my exhausted body hovering between two worlds. Life had always been hard to me, always suffering and great misunderstanding. But now I slept. My body was left behind me, left upon earth. As I soared upwards, I saw that one of the Negro women was looking down at my empty shell with great compassion on her face. Then she turned away and sat by a window, looking out upon the dingy street. Freed of the fetters of the body, I could see even more clearly the colors of the astral. These people, these colored people who were helping me when those of the white race could only persecute, were good. Suffering and hardships had refined their egos, and their insouciant attitude was merely to cover up their inner feelings. My money, all that I had earned by hardship, suffering and self-denial, was tucked beneath my pillow, as safe with these people as in the strongest bank. I soared on and on, leaving the confines of time and space, entering astral plane after astral plane. At last I reached the land of the golden light where my guide, the Lama Miniadon Up, waited to receive me. "Your sufferings have been truly great," he said, "but all that you have endured has been to good purpose. We have studied the people of Earth, and the people of strange, mistaken cults there who have and will persecute you, for they have little understanding. But now we have to discuss your future. Your present body is nearing the end of its useful life, and the plans which we have for this event must come to pass." He walked beside me along the banks of a beautiful river. The waters sparkled and seemed to be alive. On either bank there were gardens so wonderful that I could scarce believe my senses. The air itself seemed to vibrate with life. In the distance a group of people, clad in Tibetan robes, came slowly to meet us. My guide smiled at me. "This is an important meeting," he said, "for we have to plan your future. We have to see how research into the human aura can be stimulated, for we have noticed that when aura is mentioned on Earth, most people try to change the subject." The group moved nearer, and I recognized those of whom I had stood in awe. Now they smiled benevolently upon me, and greeted me as an equal. "Let us move to more comfortable surroundings," said one, "so that we may talk and discuss matters at leisure." We moved along the path in the direction from whence the men had come until, turning to follow a bend in the path, we saw before us a hall of such surpassing beauty that involuntarily I stopped with a gasp of pleasure. The walls seemed to be of purest crystal, with delicate pastel shades and undertones of color which changed as one looked. The path was soft underfoot, and it needed little urging on the part of my guide to persuade me to enter. We moved in, and it was as if we were in a great temple, a temple without dark, clean, with an atmosphere that simply made one feel that this was life. Through the main body of the building we went, until we came to what on earth I would have called the abbot's room. Here there was comfortable simplicity, with a single picture of the greater reality upon the wall. Living plants were about the walls, and from the wide windows one could see across a superb expanse of parkland. We sat upon cushions placed upon the floor, as in Tibet. I felt at home, contented almost. Thoughts of my body back on earth still disturbed me, for so long as the silver cord was intact, I would have to return. The abbot, I will call him that although he was much higher, looked about him, then spoke. "From here we have followed all that has happened to you upon the earth. We want first to remind you that you are not suffering from the effects of karma, but are instead acting as our instrument of study. For all the bad that you now suffer, so shall you have your reward." He smiled at me, and added, "Although that does not help much when you are suffering upon earth. However, he went on, we have learned much, but there are certain aspects yet to be covered. Your present body has suffered too much and will shortly fail. We have established a contact in the land of England. This person wants to leave his body. We took him to the astral plane and discussed matters with him. He is most anxious to leave, and will do all we require. At our behest he changed his name to one more suitable to you. His life has not been happy, he willingly discontinued association with relatives, friends he had never made. He is upon a harmonic of yours. For the moment we will not discuss him further, for later, before you take his body, you will see just a little of his life. Your present task is to get your body back to Tibet that it may be preserved. By your efforts and sacrifices you have amassed money, you need just a little more to pay your fare. It will come through your continued efforts. But enough for now. For a day enjoy your visit here before returning to your body. This was bliss indeed, to be with my guide. The Lama Minya donned up, not as a child, but as an adult, as one who could appreciate the great man's unusual abilities and character. We sat alone on a mossy hillside overlooking a bay of bluest water. The trees swayed to a gentle breeze and wafted to us the scent of cedar and pine. For hours we stayed thus, talking, discussing the past. My history was an open book to him, now he told me of his. So the day passed, and as the purple twilight came upon me, I knew that it was time to go, time to return to the troubled earth with its bitter man and spiteful tongues, tongues that caused the evils of earth. Hank. Oh, Hank. He is awake. There was the creak of a chair being moved, and as I opened my eyes I saw the big Negro looking down at me. He was not smiling now, his face was full of respect, awe, even. The woman crossed herself and bowed slightly as she looked in my direction. What is it? What has happened? I asked. We have seen a miracle. All of us. The big Negro's voice was hushed as he spoke. Have I caused you any trouble? I asked. No, Master, you have brought us only joy, the woman replied. I would like to make you a present, I said, reaching for my money. The Negro spoke softly, we are poor folk, but we will not take your money. Make this your home until you are ready to leave. We know what you are doing. But I would like to show my gratitude, I answered. Without you I would have died, and gone to greater glory, said the woman, adding, Master, you can give us something greater than money. Teach us to pray. For a moment I was silent, taken aback by the request. Yes, I said, I will teach you to pray, as I was taught. All religions believe in the power of prayer, but few people understand the mechanics of the process, few understand why prayers work for some and seemingly not for others. Most Westerners believe that people of the East either pray to a graven image or do not pray at all. Both statements are untrue, and I am going to tell you now how you can remove prayer from the realm of mysticism and superstition and use it to help others, for prayer is a very real thing indeed. It is one of the greatest forces on this earth when used as it was intended to be used. Most religions have a belief that each person has a guardian angel or someone who looks after him. That also is true, but the guardian angel is oneself, the other self which is at the other side of life. Very, very few people can see this angel, this guardian of theirs, while they are on the earth, but those who can are able to describe it in detail. This guardian, we must call it something, so let us call it a guardian, has not a material body such as we have on earth. It appears to be ghostly. Sometimes a clairvoyant will see it as a blue scintillating figure larger than life size and connected to the flesh body by what is known as the silver cord, that cord which pulses and glistens with life as it conveys messages from one to the other. This guardian has not a body such as that of Earth, but it is still able to do things which the Earth body can do, with the addition that it can do very many more things which the Earth body cannot. For example, the guardian can go to any part of the world in a flash. It is the guardian which does astral traveling and relays back to the body through the silver cord that which is needed. When you pray to yourself, to your other self, to your greater self. If we knew properly how to pray, we should send those prayers through the silver cord, because the telephone line we use is a very faulty sort of instrument indeed, and we have to repeat ourselves in order to make sure that the message gets through. So when you pray, speak as you would speak through a very long-distance telephone line, speak with absolute clarity, and actually think of what you are saying. The fault, I should add, lies with us here on this world, lies with the imperfect body we have on this world. The fault is not in our guardian. Pray in simple language, making sure that your requests are always positive and never negative. Having framed your prayer to be absolutely positive and to be absolutely clear of any possibility of misunderstanding, repeat that prayer perhaps 3 times. Let us take an example. Suppose, for instance, that you have a person who is ill and suffering, and you want to do something about it. You should pray for the relief of that person's suffering. You should pray 3 times, saying exactly the same thing each time. You should visualize that shadowy figure, that insubstantial figure, actually going to the house of the other person, following the route which you would follow yourself, entering the house and laying hands on that person and so effecting a cure. I will return to this particular theme in a moment, but first let me say, repeat that as many times as are necessary, and, if you really believe, then there will be an improvement. This matter of a complete cure, well, if a person has a leg amputated, no amount of prayer will replace that leg. But if a person has cancer or any other grave disease, then that can be halted. Obviously, the less the seriousness of the complaint, the easier it is to effect a cure. Everyone knows of the records of miracle cures throughout the history of the world. Lourdes and many other places are famed for their cures, and these cures are effected by the other self, by the guardian of the person concerned in association with the fame of the locality. Lourdes, for example, is known throughout the world as a place for miracle cures, so people go there utterly confident that they will be cured, and very often that confidence is passed on to the guardian of the person, and so a cure is effected very, very easily. Some people like to think that there is a saint or angel, or some ancient relic of a saint, that does the cure, but in reality each person cures himself, and if a healer gets in touch with a person with the intention of curing that sick person, then a cure is effected only through the guardian of that sick person. It all comes down, as I told you before, to yourself, the real self which you are when you leave this, the shadow life, and enter the greater reality. While upon earth we all tend to think that this is the only thing that matters, but earth, this world, no, this is the world of illusion, the world of hardship, where we come to learn lessons not so easily learned in the kinder, more generous world to which we return. You may yourself have some disability, you may be ill, or you may lack the desired esoteric power. That can be cured, it can be overcome, if you believe it and if you really want it. Suppose you have a great desire, a burning desire, to help others, you may want to be a healer. Then pray in the seclusion of your private room, perhaps your bedroom. You should rest in the most relaxed position that you can find, preferably with your feet together and with your fingers interlinked, not in the usual attitude of prayer, but with your fingers interlinked. In that way you preserve and amplify the magnetic circuit of the body, and the aura becomes stronger, and the silver cord is able to convey messages more accurately. Then, having got yourself in the right position and in the right frame of mind, you should pray. You could pray, for example, "Give me healing power that I may heal others. Give me healing power that I may heal others. Give me healing power that I may heal others." Then have a few moments while you remain in your relaxed position, and picture yourself encompassed in the shadowy outline of your own body. As I told you before, you must visualize the route you would take to the sick person's house, and then make that body travel in your imagination to the home of that person you desire to heal. Picture yourself, your over-self, arrived at the house, arrived in the presence of the person you desire to help. Picture yourself putting out your arm, your hand, and touching that person. Imagine a flow of life-giving energy going along your arm, through your fingers, into that other person like a vivid blue light. Imagine that the person is gradually becoming cured. With faith, with a little practice, it can be done. It is being done, daily, in the Far East. It is useful to place one hand in imagination on the back of the person's neck, and the other hand on or over the afflicted part. You will have to pray to yourself in groups of three prayers a number of times each day until you get the desired results. Again, if you believe, you will get results. But let me issue a grave warning.